is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays. I'm here the rest of the week, except, of course, when I'm featuring a guest host, as we are during these two very special programs. I'm borrowing the first segment only for a couple of commentaries, one about the program, the other not. Listening to Judy and Andrew yesterday was rather painful. Judy made several misleading statements. Obviously, if her research is being described as Fetzer would, it is because I have been her champion since November 2006, when we had what I believe to have been the first of our interviews. It was during this discussion that she suggested the source of energy could have been in space. She was already using the phrase beam weapon on her website, which I knew was going to generate problems of the space beam and death ray kind, but she told me she thought it was appropriate and kept the phrase. In addition, I have never been invited to present her research, so I have no idea where she got that. I do, of course, discuss her work, since I could not make a competent presentation on the World Trade Center without doing so. But my presentations are of my views on these matters, including differentiating between conventional methods, dynamite, thermite, thermate, etc., and unconventional, mini-nukes, lasers, masers, plasmoids, etc. I even have a slide that shows all of the possibilities. There is no intimation that Judy has endorsed one or another of these possibilities, but only that her work tends to disprove that conventional methods were enough to bring about the devastation. I mention them to lend some specificity to the discussion. At the very end of our conference, held in August here in Madison, a participant with a PhD in theoretical physics reported that after hearing Judy's presentation, she was convinced that masers were involved. I am unable to discriminate between these alternatives, but only indicate that the mechanism seemed to lie in this direction, which Judy and others continue to investigate. I completely reject the idea that I am taking credit for her work or not getting it right. I will create an opportunity to set the record straight, as I'm doing now, about these points. Having spent so much of my time and reputation in the defense of Judy's work, it is more than disappointing to have her make these malicious attacks on me, especially after going out of my way to have Andrew interview her to make sure her latest work was reported. I sent what I have just said to Judy Wood, Morgan Reynolds, and Jerry Liepart last night. I have had no response, but anyone who has any doubts about the extent to which I have been supportive of her work should only visit her website, drjudywood.com, and count the number of interviews that she has archived there where I featured her. She has been the most frequent guest on the Dynamic Duo since I began to host this program with Kevin Barrett. Turning to another matter, there is a new press release from scholars concerning video fakery on 9/11. You can find it online under the heading New Proof of Video Fakery on 9/11. There are two versions, one on Diet Tribune and one on Op-Ed News, because when I submitted to Op-Ed News, they asked that since I was both author but also cited in the piece, that I rewrite it in the first person, which I was glad to do. For an abstract, I am there discussing the strongest proofs of video fakery on 9/11, which appear to be that United 175 is traveling at an impossible speed for its altitude, that the entry into the South Tower with no debris is physically impossible, that this occurs in uniform motion in violation of Newton's laws, that the Nade brothers video of 9/11 reveals cutouts being created by secondary explosions, and that the Evan Fairbanks video displays similar problems. I point out that there is a difference between video fakery and no planes, since video fakery could have been used to conceal features of the planes or of their interaction with the building that needed to be concealed. However, there does appear to be significant evidence, circumstantial evidence, that supports the possibility that indeed there were no planes, including the existence of debris that is obviously planted both in New York and at the Pentagon. the absence of these time-sensitive, uniquely identifiable parts, as Colonel George Nelson has emphasized, and the fact that no envelopes, which are necessary before a plane can pull away from the terminal, have ever been produced. Even one as astute as Justin Martel has suggested I was endorsing the no-planes hypothesis. As I have explained to him, strictly speaking, I've not endorsed no planes. If I were to offer a brief tutorial in the philosophy of science, I would explain why it appears to be the hypothesis with the highest likelihood, meaning the one that confers the highest probability upon the evidence. There are four stages of scientific inquiries: puzzlement, speculation, adaptation, and explanation. An hypothesis can be preferable without also being acceptable, just as the police can have a strongest suspect in a crime but not have enough to arrest him. When all of the evidence settles down, then there is sufficient evidence to accept the preferable hypothesis. My position at this point in time is that no planes appears to be the preferable hypothesis. That is not the same as an endorsement, because I allow that more evidence and other alternatives might still turn out to provide even better explanations. I just don't see how that is possible with the evidence we have available. And I should add, new evidence becomes available practically every day. Jack White, for example, a colleague of mine from JFK Research, who's doing brilliant work also on 9/11, and whose studies can be found by introducing his name, Jack White 9/11 Studies, on Google, has turned up Fox video of what was going on at on 9/11 at Church in Murray, where this engine was purportedly found, an engine that turns out from Boeing 737 rather than a 767. Jack has a couple of frames from the film and a photo of the engine on the sidewalk with the following commentary. Newsworthy things were happening on 9/11 at Church in Murray, so Fox News was there. An FBI van is parked on Murray at the church intersection, door open. An FBI agent stands guard over something not seen in other photos at this location. Blue-clad FBI agents appear beside the van and seem to struggle with something heavy. There appear to be six FBI agents and a photographer in the video frames. Another image taken at the deserted corner right shows a dolly used for moving something. What does the complete video show? A pickup or a delivery? This appears to be the way in which this engine was placed on the location of Church in Murray, and it's obvious it was laid there because there's no destructive damage to the sidewalk that would have occurred from a weighty object hitting it at high velocity. It's up and well away from the curb, and it has all the features one might expect of a planted object. Let me add that I intend to pursue issues related to video fakery and planes or no planes during the week of the 11th through the 15th, more specifically the 12th, the 13th, and the 14th. I intend to feature several experts in this area to continue our pursuit of these issues. I'm very glad, by the way, that Andrew Johnson is hosting these interviews with Judy Wood, whose work I continue to support. I've received several compliments on the excellent job that Andrew Johnson has been performing. So I wish him well with the continuation of this special feature. Thank you all for listening. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo.
Good evening. You're listening to the Dynamic Duo. My name's Andrew Johnson, and I'm just taking over from Jim Fetzer for the rest of this program, following Jim's introduction in the first segment. I'd just make a couple of brief comments there, in that we will be sort of coming to some of the issues he raised there later on in our discussion. But I did find it interesting that our main topic of discussion yesterday was the hurricane, which we'll be discussing a little bit more about soon. And I was interested that there was no real discussion there in those remarks. So we'll come to that later. Now, I'd just also like to mention that these shows are archived. So for people who want to listen to yesterday's show again, if you missed it, to understand the context in which Jim Fetzer was making his remarks, that'll be in the archives. And there is an on-demand page as well, so if you want to listen to this show again tomorrow, you can go to the on-demand at gcnlive.com and listen again if you look for the Dynamic Duos show.
Also, I'd like to say that Dr. Wood has compiled a lot of information on her website, as we covered yesterday. There are also videos to watch of her presentations, which took place in August last year at Madison. And she also did some presentations in Seattle this year. And also, there are other presentations that we did with Ambrose Lane earlier this year in January. They're all available online. So please look for those and download them and share them. Now to get back to the main theme, I'd like to start with a quote from Defense Secretary William S. Cohen, which was made in April 1997 in a Department of Defense news briefing. The first part of this is about bioterrorism, and the second part relates to what we were talking about last night. Defense Secretary Cohen said, "There are some reports, for example, that some countries have been trying to construct something like an Ebola virus, and that would be a very dangerous phenomenon, to say the least. Alvin Toffler has written about this in terms of some scientists in their laboratories trying to devise certain types of pathogens that would be ethnic-specific, so they could just eliminate certain ethnic groups and races, and others are designing some sort of engineering, some sort of insects that can destroy specific crops. Others are engaging even in an eco-type of terrorism whereby they can alter the climate, set off earthquakes, volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves." Now, this was Defense Secretary Cohen speaking in 1997. One of the things which struck me about this paragraph, this statement, was that he doesn't mention any specific countries. Now, it would seem logical to suggest that if there are some countries who are posing this threat, then, you know, why not name them so that they can take action against them? So that's just a thought to start with. And I'm going to get Dr. Judy Wood back on the line with me very shortly. But I just wanted really to mention that we're going to do just a recap on Erin. And as you will know if you listened yesterday, one of the things which seems to have been covered up regarding 9/11 is the presence of a hurricane, which was over on the Atlantic Ocean, and it was closest to New York City on 9/11. And so I'd like to, at this point, to bring back in Dr. Judy Wood to carry on this discussion. Are you there, Judy?
Yes, I'm here. Hello.
Hi. Great to have you back. So, yes, we were talking about this hurricane, and I think if you could just recap for us on both the timing of this and the path.
The path, as you can see through the web pages, it goes straight, you know, on like a 45-degree angle between Bermuda and New York City, just aiming straight to New York City, and then it gets to right outside New York City and then just stops. Stays there for the day, and then turns around and heads directly east, heads out of town. And for a hurricane, you know, it's unusual for a hurricane to be barreling down on New York City. And not only that, to not alert the citizens, because if you have a hurricane, especially if it stalls out right outside New York City, you're going to have problems with storm surges. And I think most people know that Manhattan is just a few feet above sea level. So people should be evacuating.
Absolutely. So, you know, the question remains why very little was, spoken of with this hurricane. We were saying before we came on air that we have this tradition in England that you can talk about the weather. When you haven't really got another topic for conversation. And it seems that in relation to the weather on 9/11, very few people seem to want to talk about it. And this is quite peculiar. Now, also, I'd just like to go on a little bit from where we got to yesterday. And I know, Judy, you've done some more work on looking at some of the characteristics of the hurricane. And you can go on and find these on drjudywood.com and click on any of the links that you see labeled Erin. And I believe you've got one figure which particularly interested me, and that was the controlled environment one. And I'm wondering if you could directed
for,
to that.
First, I'd like to, if we can go back to Erin 5, where we were
yesterday.
Oh, sure,
yes, if you want to do that. So we want to go to Erin 5, okay.
And looking at the magnetometer values. And,
okay.
Someone emailed me and was feeling a little bit confused about all of the charts. I've reorganized them in a different order and cleaned them up a bit. But the biggest thing to take in right now, because there's a whole lot of data there, is to realize with the yellow charts, that's figure 10, 11, and 12, that you can see all of the values are moving along together. The H, D, and Z, those are the three orthogonal directions of magnetometer readings, that they're all moving together and all kind of near the average value. I've normalized them all to whatever average for each one.
Okay.
And then suddenly, they go wild. And they go wild for a specific length of time. And then they change to a different behavior. So if you look at these yellow charts, you can see for, you know, 3 or 4 days, they're well-behaved and right around the zero line, right around their average value. And then they suddenly split, and then boom, that's when you have a hole in the North Tower. And then, you know, they do some other, they change directions, hole in the South Tower, and then start to dive down. That's when the Tower 2 goes poof, and then stop diving down when Tower 1 goes poof. And then they're all kind of haywire till all afternoon until Building 7 goes poof, and they become pretty well behaved again, but not quite. There still seems to be something oscillating around that didn't quite get, you know, undone.
Okay, well, if people want to look at this during the break, it's Erin5 on drjudywood.com, figures 10H1, 11D1, and 12Z1. And if you look at these lines, you'll see them jumping all around the place on 9/11. And this is very, very interesting. And we'll speak again after the break. Good evening. You're listening to The Dynamic Duo. My name's Andrew Johnson, and I'm filling in for Jim Fetzer, who can be heard on the middle 3 days of the week on this program, and then Kevin Barrett is on Mondays and Fridays. I have with me tonight Dr. Judy Wood, and we're talking about Hurricane Erin and 9/11. And before the break, we were talking about the magnetometer data, and I just wanted to put a note in here that Judy has generated some of these new charts herself from the data that she's downloaded, and so we have points of data every minute. So this has generated quite a lot of data to work with. And so you can see much more clearly the patterns in the changes of the magnetic field. Now, this next part that we wanted to go on to is looking at some other aspects of the hurricane data, which is from, I believe, the Hurricane Center, Judy. Can you take us through to that, please?
Yes, at the top or bottom of Erin 5, there's a link that goes to Erin 9.
Okay.
That's just what I numbered it right now while I'm gathering the information. This is from the National Hurricane Center, and their readings on the lowest pressure values of the hurricane, or the pressure values at any moment, the wind speed, and I plotted on there the location from New York City, this is where the center is of the hurricane. Why I say, the location, in quotes, or distance in quotes, I use the latitude and longitude information, and it's approximately a factor of 14, from 14 times 4 times the degrees. But I multiplied that value by 4 to plot it on the chart just to fit it on the scale. But it's relative to the distance, so you can see where it's the closest and where it's the furthest away. The closest, the center, was 465 miles, something like that. And mind you, this thing was like 500 miles in diameter. So it's within, you know, almost 200 miles from shore. That's pretty close to shore. For a hurricane to be aiming directly towards New York City, how could they know it was just going to stop and turn around and head out of town? And no point in alerting anybody, just in case. It, you know, they must have known exactly what, you know, what its behavior is going to be. Now, here in the top of page 9, Aaron 9, is what the values were during the time the towers were going poof. And
okay.
You'll notice this is in figure 2, or this is figure 7. It's right below figure 1.
Underneath the red herring, which the red heading, which says a controlled environment.
Yes, thanks. There's a red curve that shows wind speed, then there's the pink one showing the pressure, and then the blue showing the approximate distance or relative distance. And you can see that it gets the closest and kind of flattens out for 2 p.m. the day before, or 2 a.m. to about 2 p.m. It's the closest to New York City and pretty much stationary. And during that time, like 8 p.m. the night before to 8 p.m. on 9/11, the wind speed stayed absolutely constant. And from 2 a.m. on 9/11 to 8 p.m. on 9/11, the pressure stayed constant. So it stayed constant, the pressure, the wind, and the hurricane didn't move. That's a pretty controlled environment.
Yeah, it's just incredible to think of. Even if you only consider that the barometric pressure had stayed constant for all that period of time, how many hours would that be altogether, Judy? How many hours are we looking at? We've got flat lines between 2 a.m. and 8 p.m. for two of them, which is,
at least 24 hours.
Yeah. It's incredible to look at that data, and I think you've done a fantastic job to kind of pull that out and plot it in this way. I discussed this with you, while you were doing this, and it's just something I would never have thought of doing myself. So I think it's marvelous that you've actually just, pulled this data out and made it so clear that you can see how this has been really focused in on. And, I have to say, without any shadow of a doubt for myself, other people are obviously free to disagree with me if they wish, but this, as you said, is a controlled environment. This is weather control, and, the data is here for anyone to look at and see that that's what happened.
Well, it's very predictable. It's, if the weather is exactly the same for 24 hours, well, not exactly the same, the hurricane, what it was doing was the same for 24 hours.
Mm.
12 hours before, 12 hours after. And I've also plotted some other information below that. I was looking at other hurricanes and comparing what do they look like. And I've yet to find any other hurricane that takes this path of going perpendicular to land, going straight in and then make a right-angle turn and head out of town, or more than the right-angle turn. They usually go up the coast. They don't go towards the coast and then, make a right-hand turn.
Yes, I know that you've been looking very closely at some of the other hurricanes to see, if this was some kind of normal effect. I mean, looking at this data, you can't really, see how it could be. But nevertheless, I think you've done absolutely the right thing in, going and looking at the other hurricane data to see, what things you can learn from that. So this is very, very interesting. And I believe, I think at this point, we can bring in Shalel, who's called in. Are you there? Can we bring Shalel in, please?
Yeah.
Hello? Anybody there? Maybe they've gone. It's all gone quiet. Are you there, Judy?
Yes, I'm here.
I don't think Shalel's there. Maybe
he's
got to go.
I'm hearing you.
Oh, you're here. Oh, right. You're with us now. Hi.
I'm here.
Welcome to the Dynamic Duo.
Hi, Andrew. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
Hi. I really, really, really appreciate all that you've put. It's just... I spend days on your website. It's just wonderful. And I came across something that spurred me. I'm an electrical engineer that spurred a thought, which was on page 4 of the Aaron studies. Figure 16?
It's what?
Figure 16
figure
on
16,
page 4,
it
yeah.
It looks like a very high-quality audio tube amplifier. And I got to thinking... about tubes and the effects that you're talking about, and this giant ionospheric heater that they have up in Alaska.
Okay.
Would affect your magnetometer readings, I'll bet. But what it made me envision was the fact that there's a circuit of energy, you know, not just light comes from the sun, but all these electromagnetic frequencies, including microwaves, whatever, are all being funneled into the magnetosphere of the planet. And that has to be dissipated as heat. So they're able, you know, looking at the tube, with a grid on a tube, you can, a very small change in current can affect a very large amount of current to drive speakers, say, you know?
True.
And I think they're using this HARP array to modulate that energy that's coming in from the sun, which is an enormous amount of energy, you know? And you see it. If you research even some of the other hurricanes that have happened that have been kind of weird, like Katrina. There's all sorts of anomalies in the radar data there, too. Stuff that looks not natural, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Could you comment on that, Judy? And also, if you could give us an update on the quartz after the break.
Okay.
Thank you for your work.
Thank you very much.
We'll get back to that after the break. And this is the Dynamic Duo, and I'm Andrew Johnson, and my guest is Dr. Judy Wood. And we'll speak to you after the break.
The Dynamic Duo, and my name is Andrew Johnson, and I have with me on the line Dr. Judy Wood. We're talking about 9/11 and Hurricane Erin, and we should soon be moving on to other evidence. We just had a caller, Shalel, before the break, who mentioned some of the issues we've been talking about in relation to HARP, which is the High Altitude Active Auroral Research Program, and the facility in Alaska. Now, we have sort of looked at a little bit of this, but we haven't really linked it into this study, because we don't really have enough data as to what, you know, it actually does. We're told that it's an ionospheric heater, and the official disclosed wattage of power is something like a megawatt, but actually I think the undisclosed power is much higher, and it's said to be able to do earth-penetrating tomography and this sort of thing, which is like an underground type of radar. But I really don't know exactly what it's doing day in and day out, and I don't know if you've got any further comments that you'd like to add to Shalal's points before we just go back a little way to what we were talking about before.
Well, he may be completely right on target. I do know about magnetic reconnection, and there's a whole lot of weird signals that go around the Earth. But as for HARP, I don't know what it is. I say it's I put in the category of he said, she said, who said, what said. You know,
yeah.
I want to see the evidence. I don't know what it does. I just know what they told us it does, or some of the stories. But say I'm from Missouri, show me. I need proof that that's what it does. But meanwhile, I'm just looking at the data, and what does the data tell me? I don't need anybody else to interpret it. I can see it and see what's happening. And what I see, you know, with this weather data is something very unusual happened, and I think we all kind of know it. Because I think we all realized on 9/11 it was an unusually clear sky, the clearest sky over New York and D.C. that I think we'd had in decades.
And I just might tie into what something that Jim Fetzer said in the introduction, which is a video fakery. Somebody sent us an email yesterday talking about it was the best blue screen facility, you know, on 9/11.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely was. But with this, you know, data, I've got other bunches of data that I collect from the JFK airport. And
okay. On
the Erin 9 page.
Okay, so we
and
go back to Erin 9 again.
And rather getting confused with all of the data on there, if you look through there, you'll notice it's in figure 4. It's a blue long chart. It's currently numbered 4. It'll get a new number. Where the humidity drops from 80% relative humidity to 40% relative humidity within an hour.
Okay,
less than an hour.
Figure four, whereabouts is that, Jude? I'm having difficulty
finding
it.
It's around midway down the page.
About midway down, so it's about halfway down, drjudywood.com.
It's under Hurricane Aaron.
Page 9. Figure 4, right, so it's got a blue border on this chart, and it's labeled Figure 4, Erin, humidity, dew point, temperature. Is that the one?
Yes, that one.
Okay.
I apologize for not having all the numbers. I was just getting the chart cleaned up.
Yeah, I mean, there's such a lot of data here, Judy. I understand it's difficult to organize it all in a short space of time.
But you'll see about two-thirds of the way from left to right, a whole bunch of vertical bars. Each one of those lines represents something. The closest the hurricane was to New York, as well as when the North Tower got its hole, when the South Tower got its hole, when the North or the South Tower went poof, and the North Tower went poof, and then later when Building 7 went poof.
Okay, and you've got a key to those, the colors of those lines, about just near the middle of this, that chart, at the bottom.
Right, and in any of these, if you click on them, you should get a big one. But the key thing is to look at that pink curve. You see, it just dives right down. Well, the towers are going poof.
Wow.
Why would the humidity suddenly drop there? I see that's evidence of field effects. Intentional or unintentional, we won't, you know, need to decide that, but we have evidence of field effects.
Now, can you just clarify this with me in terms of, because the dew point is affected normally by the temperature, that's correct, isn't it?
No, the relative humidity is affected by temperature.
Oh, okay, yes, sorry, yes, the dew point is a temperature. I'm getting mixed up here.
Right.
So I think the key thing here was that we wanted to, you know, I just think we need to clarify that the humidity should not change if the temperature doesn't change. Is that correct?
Unless something else is going on.
Yes.
Normally, you'd have, you know, the high heat of the day, the relative humidity goes down. And then as the temperature goes down in the afternoon and evening, the relative humidity goes up. And that's why you get moisture on things, why you get dew.
Okay.
Because the air can't hold as much moisture. So when you see the temperature rising, you should see relative humidity going down. But when you see temperature going down, you would expect relative humidity to be going up.
Right.
But what this chart shows is they both go down.
Yes, and that's just where we've got this sort of close sequence of fine lines, isn't it, where you've got the pink line dips very sharply and the temperature dips also, and that's about in the roughly the middle of the chart, just to the right of the key, isn't it? I'm just trying to focus down so that people know where to look. So just to clarify that, we're seeing both the temperature drop and also the humidity drops as well, which shouldn't happen.
The relative humidity dropping.
Humidity drops, get that word relative in.
There's some other interesting things that were noted. That the wind stayed at about constant speed, you know, a little faster, a little slower, but reverse direction.
Okay.
So we definitely have New York City sensing that hurricane.
Okay.
That's the bottom line here.
Yeah. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. These read into JFK Airport, is that correct?
Correct.
All right, okay.
And they sensed there's a something happening with the weather. Now, there was a cold front that came in, and you get a cold front that moves under moist air. It dries out the air, and that's what we see. And that's what drove the hurricane out. But the timing was just so impeccable. And also what happens is when you have dry air underneath the storm system, you get an electrical effect. You get this kind of arcing like thunder. And we have quite a few airports around that area reporting thunder, including JFK Airport. JFK Airport reported rain on 9/11 and reported thunder on 9/11.
Very
interesting. Those reports are down at the bottom of that page. I found several of them that measured 0.03 inches of rain, 0.01 inches, and JFK reported 0.69 inches of rain. But there's 6 airports in that area that reported thunder. Why would there be thunder?
Well, this is very interesting because, you know, we had a clear blue sky, so there should be no thunder.
I believe that's evidence of field effects.
Yes, I would tend to agree. Something very strange was going on, and obviously with the amount of data you've gathered here and the way that you've presented it, it's very, very clear to me that, you know, anyone who says that this was a normal day weather-wise and hurricane-wise is going to have a hard time justifying that statement.
Correct. And I've got a comparison here with Hurricane Alex and Hurricane Aaron. You can compare the behavior of the two. All the data collected at JFK Airport.
Okay. And when was Hurricane Alex, if you could remind us?
2004. And it went up the coast, and it went right past New York. Kind of intersects the same route. I'll later put up a chart that shows both routes at the same time. Basically, Hurricane Aaron's path went and intersected Hurricane Alex's path at right angles and then joined it, essentially.
Okay.
So it went to about the same distance from the city, from New York City, and from JFK. So the sensing should be about the same. Does it? You know, you can see in the Hurricane Alex plot where there's a hurricane going by, and also you get that dry air drop.
Right. Okay, well, we've got the music now, so we're coming up to another break. My guest is Dr. Judy Wood. This is the Dynamic Hero. My name is Andrew Johnson, and we'll be back after the break. Dynamic Hero. My name is Andrew Johnson. You would normally find Jim Fetzer here in the middle 3 days of the week and Kevin Barrett on Mondays and Fridays. However, today I'm guest hosting, and my guest is Dr. Judy Wood, and we're talking about Hurricane Erin and 9/11. And Judy has compiled an extremely interesting set of data, quite overwhelming, some of it, when you go onto her website and look. But nevertheless, I would say that we can clearly see strong evidence of weather modification and weather control on 9/11. And Judy had just some additional comments to add to what we were previously talking about. So if you want to take us from there, please, Judy.
What I've been talking about is on Erin 9, but I'd like to go to Erin 4. But meanwhile,
okay,
what we've been talking about is field effects. We have first on Erin 4, on Erin 5 earlier, we were talking about the magnetometer data. And then on Erin 9, we're talking about the weather data from JFK Airport and also from the Hurricane Center. And the field effects that you get with that cause thunder. And we get lightning with storms because of that.
Okay.
Remember, it's a separate issue, the magnetometer information. So we have two different kinds of fields. And neither one of these involve an extension cord plugged into a power supply. So that's a myth that I would like to clear up as straightforward as possible, that there's a lot of, and I think Jim Fetzer gets this incorrect, maybe innocently, but I'm not talking about this being a power source. I'm talking about this being a field. This generates a field. We don't worry about who's powering a thunderstorm. It's not even the power that's coming from that. It's the field it generates. And why that's important is because of what's on page 4. If you look on the Erin 4 page, halfway down, I'm talking about this coil effect of a hurricane or a tornado. They have this spiral action up the center, and then a big pie plate, you know, spin around the top, like a Tesla coil. And if you go further down the page, you see effects of that, and then there's also some effects, the Hutchison effect, that do the same thing. So we see an equivalent, parallel with the Hutchison effect.
Absolutely, and then the two, parts of that that stand out to me the most are the effects on materials, where we've seen with the Hutchison effect we've got dissimilar materials merging, and also with the tornado or storm effects we've seen dissimilar materials merging in terms of pictures you've got there. That's essentially what you're illustrating on that part of the page.
Right. You have straw in a tree. From, we hear about that all the time for hurricanes. and John Hutchison has a piece of wood in aluminum. Dissimilar materials.
And I think it's worth further illustrating this with the figure 49B that you've got there, which is quite a well-circulated picture, but I think this explains it much better than any other explanation. And it's the fusion of dissimilar materials in the World Trade Center residue, if I can call it that, where we've got that figure 49B with a whole collection of materials in a single blob there.
Including paper. Remember, somebody's expense account was in there. The word expenses is in there.
And, of course, if this was a heating process with very high heat to actually make the metal, you know, amalgamate like that, then how could the paper survive? It doesn't make any sense.
And 49A, we have this file cabinet, the only file cabinet found at the World Trade Center complex. And you've got this bright blue and bright red folder divider still in it.
Absolutely. And so I think, you know, what I think we can do at this point, unless you want to sort of go on to something else, is we can recap on the Hutchison effect. And, you know, this is what really got my attention in terms of things like the upside-down cars. You know, which we've also seen after, with storm effects as well that you've listed. And I think also it's worth pointing out, Judy, that what we're seeing is an interference effect with the fields. And I think if you can sort of just describe how, you know, you came onto this with the car issue, and you noticed this, the way that the car, one of the cars was toasted in a particular way, and that was to do with what's called interference, and that is also a result of fields, isn't it?
Correct. And when I first began calling this, the Star Wars beam weapons, and I didn't know the term directed energy weapons. I didn't know what that was. And I do not call this Star Wars weapon or Star Wars beam. No, it's the Star Wars program under which this was developed. And I think the title of the article is even something like the Star Wars directed energy weapons, brought to you by the Star Wars program.
Yeah. I mean, this was obviously the name that Ronald Reagan gave to it, presumably so that he could understand it, or something like that. Yeah, I mean, the Hutchison effect, I mean, I think this really takes us on to the whole energy question, because what John Hutchison says, if you listen to some of his radio broadcasts, is that he feels that he's tapping into another kind of energy source which is intrinsic within either the zero-point field or intrinsic to the material, and we're seeing this outflow of energy with a small input energy. And this, of course, is what seems to have been discovered in a different context, slightly different context, by Pons and Fleischmann with their cold fusion experiments. So perhaps we could just sort of talk about this a little bit, because it has been discussed on this program before. I don't think we fully connected it to the Hutchison effect.
Which, cold fusion?
Yes, cold fusion.
Correct. I've looked at them all as like some big, you know, vat of information over here, because I don't think there's any distinct division from one thing to the other. It's all a form of tapping into some kind of energy. And there's been talk about the tritium values. And that always jumped out at me because Fleischmann Malov in his book has a chart, and he was talking about in an interview I was listening to, where there's an amount of tritium that is produced from cold fusion. It's not a huge amount. It's like five times normal rather than thousands of times normal. The thousands of times would be like if a nuke was set off. But if it's like five times normal, that's what you would find with cold fusion stuff. And folks who are, you know, hung up on a nuclear event, and I have never, you know, eliminated a nuclear process, but it is not a nuke, you know, discrete nuke.
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree, because if you try and talk about nuclear explosions at the World Trade Center, the evidence doesn't really add up, because it would be a huge sound volume of explosion. Some people say it's micro-nukes. Well, if that was true, what type of micro-nuke was it? Why wasn't there a lot of heat? Why didn't we see very bright, blinding flashes of light? Because we know that nuclear explosions are very brilliant.
And why didn't it burn the paper? We had paper all over the street.
Yeah, and it would have burned the paper. So the nuclear explanation, it just really doesn't, in my view, it doesn't explain hardly any of the evidence, apart from perhaps the sheer level of destruction. That's about the only thing it explains, but it doesn't explain any of the other evidence. So, you know, I looked at that for a short period of time, and I will, you know, say it just doesn't explain the evidence. So, you know, you might as well just really not get, pay much attention
to
that.
But folks need to find out some explanation for the tritium. Well, here you go. It's, you know, cold fusion produces tritium values, you know, above normal.
And I think it's worth mentioning that Dr. Eugene Malloff, who you mentioned briefly there, he used to work at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he was a lead science writer, and he wrote this book, which you can still get. It's out of print, I believe, but you can get it on Amazon if you're lucky, on the second-hand sort of sections. It's called Fire from Ice, and in that book he featured about 100 pages where he mentions a certain person called Stephen E. Jones. And Stephen E. Jones was involved in the field of muon-catalyzed cold fusion. And this is the same Stephen E. Jones who's come out with the thermite theory about the destruction of the World Trade Center. But we'll be back after the break. This is Andrew Johnson. This is the Dynamic Duo. And we'll be back after the break. Good evening. Thanks for listening. This is GCN Live. And it's the Dynamic Duo with me, Andrew Johnson, and Dr. Judy Wood is my guest, and we're talking about 9/11, Hurricane Erin, and energy and the Hutchison effect. And we were discussing before the break the work of Dr. Eugene Malloff and his book Fire from Ice, which documents the cold fusion cover-up of the late 80s and 1990s, and the role in that of Professor Stephen E. Jones, who worked on muon-catalyzed cold fusion. And this whole free energy field is, of course, very interesting to study and research. And I understand that Dr. Wood also has an interest in this area because one of her students that she described to me was also interested in this free energy and cold fusion type of area. So if you could describe that to us, please, Judy.
Yeah, I had a student that that came up to me and got interested. He'd seen my website and read up thoroughly through it before he even came up and started talking to me. And it was dynamite. I was working on the billiard ball issue then, trying to convince people, you know, to pay attention to that, and I wasn't ready to go on to other things just yet. But he said it involved free energy. He strongly felt that it involved free energy of how it was done. And he talked about his uncle, the inventor. I thought, well, this is a student, you know, who thinks highly of his uncle. And I was intrigued, and he was going to tell me more about it after spring break. Well, he never returned from spring break. That was Michael Zieber, who was murdered during spring break.
This is terrible, because we also know that Dr. Malloff was also murdered 17th of May 2004. And the very disturbing factor in this is that Malloff was murdered apparently in some kind of burglary that gone wrong. That's what the paper said about this. And I believe that, tragically, Michael was also ended up being shot during some type of bizarre mugging. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was supposedly a robbery gone bad, but they gave the thugs the purse, and the thugs were leaving and then turned around and shot Michael in the head twice and left three witnesses, you know, assassination style, which is, you know, pretty horrible to do it in front of his mother and his sister, and it was just—I can't think of anything worse for a mother.
Mm.
But I found out who Michael's uncle was. Michael spoke of him, you know, his uncle, the inventor.
Right.
He worked with Eugene Malloff.
Well, this is just, you know, an incredible connection to consider. You know, some people would say, well, it's probably just some kind of horrible coincidence, but I think, you know, really if you explore this area and you understand what's at stake with the sort of things that we're discussing and really think about this, I don't think it's really going to take you too long to sort of come to a conclusion. But obviously we must leave people to make that, you know, conclusion for themselves. And I think, Judy, what I wanted to also just get in at this point was the idea, we tried to speak about this last year, actually, and if we take it that the weapon was used on 9/11 to do the destruction at the World Trade Center, and we've already mentioned that it looked, in some respects, like a nuclear event of some kind. And then last year we talked about this, and we were going to go on with Ambrose Lane on his show on the Power XM channel, and that was on the 27th of July 2007. And we were going to sort of just mention that we thought that having this type of weapon could give them the perfect cover for apparently setting off a nuclear explosive and blaming it on Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
And we even had Stephen E. Jones mentioning this in a talk in June last year, and this is all documented on my website, checktheevidence.com. Lots of stuff on there. Also, Judy, I think, again, I wanted to mention the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, which has sort of bears some relation to this. And also, perhaps you can, you know, tell everyone what happened with the Ambrose Lane show that I just mentioned.
Yeah, Edward and I were going to be on that show together, and we're waiting for our phone call. And we waited, and the phone call didn't come. 30 minutes went by. We emailed back and forth. Are you getting your call yet? Nope. It was about 2 hours later I got a phone call from someone else who said Ambrose had just been fired. He was fired like just minutes before the show was to begin.
Yeah, I mean, I also heard from our friend Frank that he was driving into his parking space when he learned that he no longer had a job on that show, and he was apparently one of the most, if not the most popular host on that network. I've written an article about this and posted it on the website, so you can go and check that out. Now, I had a message from Russ here, our friend Russ, and he's mentioned that there is this timeline of events which we mentioned Dr. Eugene Malov and Michael Zabur and the tragic events that they were part of, and this has been compiled into a timeline which Russ has put together, which is also on checktheevidence.com. So you can have a look at that if you get the time. But I think, you know, we wanted to cover quite a few more things before the end of the program, and I just wanted a quick sort of update on the Keytam case, Judy, because we haven't talked about that for a while, and I wondered if there was anything you can tell us about that.
Well, I can't tell you a whole lot because it's an ongoing case.
Okay.
And a decision was made, and folks can read about that decision on my website. I've posted it, and an appeal has been filed. So we will wait and see what happens with that.
Okay. And can we talk about the contents of that decision briefly that the judge posted? There were some unusual things in there, I believe.
Well, I'll stay out of it, but you can say whatever you need to say. But
okay. I did look through that. I didn't read every word of it, but what puzzled me was the references to the moon landings and the Kennedy assassination, which of course had nothing to do with the evidence that you'd submitted because you didn't even mention those topics. And also, what struck me was that there were three cases, Dr. Reynolds and yours, and the one by Ed Haas, which I wasn't previously aware of, actually. And the judge used, I believe, the same document in his ruling on all three of those cases. I believe that's correct.
And two of them were QTAM cases, and one was...
Yeah, and the other one was some kind of administrative law or something, I can't remember. But yes, very, very strange outcome there. And again, Judy's website has all the details there for those that want to check that out. And now I think I want to move on, because there has been a lot of controversy around this information, and I think whatever we've said tonight and whatever we say in the next sort of half an hour or so before the end of the program, please, the main thing is to check all the information for yourselves, think for yourselves, make your own minds up. Don't be led by what we say, even though we might appear to be, or I might appear to be, quite forceful in the way that I express things in some cases. But I think I just wanted to mention this phrase that Lenin said. He was the first communist dictator after the takeover of Russia in 1917. And he's widely credited with this following quotation: "The best way to control the opposition is to lead it ourselves." And that now takes us into the commercial break again. And we'll be talking more about what we think the opposition to this is and what they're doing after the break. So thank you very much for listening. It's Andrew Johnson on the Dynamic Duo with my guest, Dr. Judy Wood. For the Dynamic Duo, my name is Andrew Johnson, and with me this evening is Dr. Judy Wood. We're talking about energy, 9/11, Hurricane Erin, and weather modification. But I left you before the break talking about leading the opposition. Lenin said the best way to control the opposition is to lead it ourselves. Now, there's been a lot of opposition to Dr. Wood's diligent work, and one of the things that we found when we tried to discuss this in a rational manner on various forums is that quite often people will post this strange video which was made by Dr. Greg Jenkins, as if this somehow debunks Dr. Wood. And this is a very strange video. And actually, I think I should get on record here that this video was recorded at midnight in a room where Dr. Jenkins did not have permission to use. He came with a set of two cameras and lighting.
And a film crew.
Sorry, do you want to take up the story, Judy?
Professional film crew. And
okay.
And lighting and multiple cameras. And this was a room that were a talk I was attending. I was a member of the audience. And
okay.
It's interesting that only two people knew I was going to be at that talk in the audience.
Oh, really? Mm.
And it's interesting that Jenkins went to all this effort. And someone came up to me afterwards and said, well, can you answer a few questions? They had a piece of paper and a pencil. It looks like they're going to take notes. I said, yeah, but can I go to the bathroom first? Well, no, it's just a few questions. And they lead me to this room through a room. You know, it's a couple of rooms over. And you walk in, you realize you've been had. Because if I turn around and leave, it's already on film. Oh, she can't handle answering questions. She's leaving. And whatever way they're going to distort it. I don't mind answering questions. It just seemed it was obviously, underhanded, whatever was going on.
Exactly. And I think the thing that there was a lot of things which irritated me about that interview, one of which was it was posted and edited without your permission. And I think if you look at the version that's posted, they have some silly song at the beginning, and then they have the picture which generated the most discussion. It's actually a different picture from the one that you were shown in terms of the quality of the picture and the color. So they had this whole debate, and the whole video is set up from the beginning to give the viewer a certain impression. And this is essentially another one of these psyops, which I think we're going to try and spend a few minutes on later.
It's equivalent of if I show you a picture of a cow and film it, and you don't really know what we're talking about, and then I edit the video and put beforehand a picture of a horse and say, actually, that person doesn't even know what a horse looks like. They're calling it a cow.
And I think also I wanted to mention that, in particular to Dr. Jenkins, who is associated with DC 9/11 Truth, I think he's written just three or four articles which have been posted on the Journal of 9/11 Studies, and they're all to do with how the directed energy weapon could not possibly have destroyed the buildings for various reasons. But again, if you scrutinize this article carefully, you can see that the reasons he uses are extremely dubious. So, he doesn't really have any sort of evidence on which to base his arguments. And, of course, these articles and the video was done before Dr. Wood had kind of gathered the data in relation to the Hutchison effect. And we haven't seen any comments from Greg Jenkins about the Hutchison effect. I believe I'm correct in saying that, Judy.
Mm-hmm.
And also, this brings on another theme of researchers not engaging with this data. We've seen very, very few people actually willing to talk about the Hutchison effect. We've actually seen an active, effort to try and discourage discussion of this. For example, we saw Ace Baker produce a fake video, and initially he said he'd got Tesla calls and produced the effect. Again, we've written articles about this to document the emails, which we'll exchange back and forth on this matter. Jim Fetzer had Ace Baker on this program, probably, when was it? I think it was in February. And, Jim Fetzer agreed with Ace. I mean, strangely, this was extremely strange to me because you are the most highly qualified 9/11 researcher. You've got the 3 degrees. And yet, Jim Fetzer decided that Ace Baker, who is a graduate of I can't remember if it's which particular degree he's got, but I don't believe
he's got, I think, a bachelor's degree in film or something like that. But
okay. Now, so he basically doesn't have a strong...
Music, supposedly.
Yeah, okay. Well, he doesn't have a strong science background, and so, you know, oddly, Jim Fetzer was deciding that Ace was correct and that Hutchison was very likely a fraud. According to Ace Baker, Hutchison was 100% fraud, which I think is a bit extreme, but, you know, if we take the view that we have got this opposition who wants to suppress discussion of this evidence, then I think, you know, we can see the rationale behind that kind of effort. And again, we've documented this in the articles, which I hope people will read and, you know, make their own minds up, really. It's the most important thing.
Well, I thought it was interesting that Jim Fetzer had John Hutchison on his show the day after the Ace Baker event. And instead of letting John tell his story about how defense contractors came to his place for 4 months and videotaped his stuff, instead, you know, Fetzer was focused on what John's income was 30 years ago.
Absolutely. And I mean, I distinctly remember his program with you where you were taking him through things like the things that we was commenting on earlier, the very easy to understand things such as this car is upside down, this car is upside down, and this car is upside down. Why is this? And, you know, Jim Fetzer was extremely quiet and didn't really have any comments on this. And as you mentioned on the next program with John, he didn't really give John a chance to describe when Colonel John Alexander, who has worked at Stanford Research Institute, went to see and worked.
He interrupted and wanted to know where he grew up.
No, and he just asked John about his income for the last 30 years or something, which was very strange. I've never heard John ask those questions on any other radio program.
No, I don't think we know what Ace Baker's income was 30 years ago.
I don't know. I mean, it's not the sort of thing we would want to discuss, really. If you and I were, you know, discussing these sorts of things, we would look at the evidence and ask John about his experiments and how he generated the effects. You know, those are the things that really interest me.
What's also been interesting is in the past few weeks even, I've gotten emails from folks who are offering me this, that, and the other. If I, you know, drop all... connection with John Hutchison.
It's very interesting how, does seem to have been an active effort to, discourage the association of these ideas. And I think, the danger is that people are going to connect the dots and actually begin to find out what's really going on. You know, that's what I feel. And just to give a couple more examples of these attempts to shut down discussion, I know you did this, presentation in Seattle and then John Hutchison did one at the same venue. That's correct, I believe.
Yeah, John's was first and mine was next, and those videos are on my website.
Absolutely.
And
I think if you can mention what the Seattle 9/11 Truth Group did in response to your, the knowledge that you were going to come and give this presentation.
The fellow who was manning the website didn't want anything to do with it. Thought it was horrible that Judy Wood was going to be there or John Hutchison was going to be there, and he actually took down the website, destroyed it.
So the reaction to this evidence, where we've documented or you've documented the effects, which correspond between the World Trade Center evidence and the Hutchison effect evidence, with the bent beams, the upturned cars, the ongoing effects, the Bankers Trust building, all this amazing evidence. The reaction of the 9/11 Truth Group in Seattle, not all of them, of course, but the owner of the website, was to shut down the website. That was his best way of giving you publicity, it would seem.
And truth doesn't need protection.
Correct. You know, and I experienced this as well with this situation, because when you'd, collected the Erin data to your satisfaction, I said, well, we need to get a press release out for this, and so I posted this. And then Op-Ed News, a popular news site, actually censored the press release, and I submitted it, and it was approved on another website that I use. Op-Ed News censored the whole press release and wouldn't post it. My name's Andrew Johnson. We'll be back after the break with the Dynamic Duo and my guest, Dr. Judy Wood. Thanks for listening. Good evening. This is the Dynamic Duo. My name is Andrew Johnson, and I have with me on the line Dr. Judy Wood. We're talking about 9/11, Hurricane Erin, energy, and the attempted suppression of discussion of this information, which we seem to have been experiencing over the last, over a year, really. And I mentioned before the break how I'd written this press release once Dr. Wood had collected the evidence about Erin, and I tried to post this on Op-Ed News, and it was actually censored. This was very troubling because it had been approved on another website that I used, PRLog. And I think this brings us on to this whole idea of, you know, them trying to shut down discussion of these topics. And I'll just give a couple of brief examples that we came across, and we've seen this quite a lot. But Jeff, who is a forum administrator on Rigorous Intuition, he wrote, "I'm not budging on Wood and Reynolds. Call me a gatekeeper if you like, but it's my gate, and I'm keeping it." And then this thread of discussion, which was about the Wood and Reynolds cases or evidence related to those, was locked. And we've seen this repeated. We have a UK forum here called Rent, and the editor, who was a moderator, went under the name of editor, he said of a post related to Judy Woods' Erican study, "Move to the bin. Judy Woods and the rest of those truthers are on a different planet. I've seen them abusing forum after forum. If I catch any of them in here, they will be banned immediately." And that was from one of the moderators of the forum. And this is despite all this evidence, and now Judy is informed of the additional evidence she's been compiling. And this was just completely shut down. So, you know, we really need to stress again the importance of you looking at the evidence for yourselves and thinking for yourselves and deciding whether, you know, these sorts of actions on these forums are fair. And just, you know, if you wanted to add to any of that, Judy.
Well, not just are they fair, but, you know, it gives you a perfect, roadmap as to what to look at. If somebody tells me not to look at something, that's what I want to go look at. And actually that is what gave me a lot of information is Greg Jenkins, what he was trying to hide, that's what I went and looked at, and that's when I started realizing about the molecular dissociation and more things. But looking at the evidence for ourselves is important, and it's not difficult, it's not complicated, it's not controversial. The buildings are gone. You know, by noon, there was very little material left.
Absolutely.
Where did the building go? That's not controversy.
No, it's not technical. I mean, it's labeled as being controversial, but when you actually start looking at the evidence for yourself, you come to realize that this is just really another psyop, and it's meant to kind of discourage you from looking at the evidence. And another, you know, there's several other tactics like debunking it. We had an email or a post made in the last couple of days where somebody claimed to have debunked all of this evidence completely and was proud of it. I mean, is this somebody who's looking for the truth of a matter?
They don't repeat what they debunked it with. They just said it was debunked. They just take their word for it. It's debunked.
Yeah, yeah. So you either take people at their word or you go and check for yourself. And, you know, I think the point, again, that needs to be stressed is that the evidence that Dr. Wood and Dr. Reynolds have compiled, they knew that it was strong enough to take to court, so they took it to court or attempted to take it to court. And, you know, a lot of people are going around asking for a new inquiry and this type of thing. But, you know, you have to ask yourself, and I've started asking people this, who will do the inquiry? Who will do it? I mean, people say, oh, we should have a congressional inquiry. I mean, you know, what would be your comments on that, Judy, you know, regarding the state of the Congress?
I mean, the same Congress that passed the Patriot Act? You're going to ask them for another investigation?
Well, this is it. I mean, you know, what investigations have we had into 9/11?
One by Wood and one by Reynolds.
Yes, well, those are the only genuine ones, I think. But we have the 9/11 Commission and FEMA. And, you know, so who's going to do the investigation? And I think at this point as well, you know, we might just mention again the RFCs that you did. And I'm thinking in relation to the other RFC, which was, handed in by the opposition. And recently I heard Professor Stephen E. Jones on a program called Clout, which is on Air America, I believe. Is that correct, Judy?
I think so. I'm not sure.
We listened to this program. This was in May. And this was with a demolition expert. I can't remember the guy's name. And Kevin Barrett was on this program as well. And the host, who I think was Richard Green, questioned Dr. Stephen E. Jones about the use of thermite and how it could have been, you know, put into the World Trade Center towers to, you know, use the destruction. And his response at one point in the conversation was that it could have been painted on in a matter of several weeks. And this is what he actually said. Now, so we have Professor Stephen E. Jones saying that this thermite could have been painted on. He didn't really present any evidence that it was actually painted on. And why I mentioned the RFC, which is the what's called the request for correction, was that this thermite theory he's been, you know, discussing, and he's written papers about it in his peer-reviewed journal, and he's posted it on the Journal of 9/11 Studies website there. But yet, I think, you know, you pointed out to me, because I haven't noticed, that there is no mention of thermite in this request for correction that James Gourley submitted to NIST on behalf of Stephen E. Jones and several others. I believe that's correct.
Yes, it's. I did a word search on it, and I think somebody else had posted it around on some forums. So in their appeal, they mentioned thermite, but not their thermite. They just used it as a hypothetical example.
Yes,
but
that's right.
But the original RFC didn't even contain the word thermite.
And, I mean, if you read the RFC, it does indeed, to a degree, eulogize Stephen E. Jones as a respected scientist, which may or may not be true. But I believe that, you know, if you've got some evidence which you think can stand up in court, i.e. that you think thermite brought down the towers, it only seems right and proper for me that you should put that in a request for correction, so that you can get that into the required, you know, court documents ultimately, whether that's through a key town as you have done or some other process.
These all seem to be games to keep us from looking at the evidence. People have faith in looking here, looking there, following, you know, the leader somewhere. You know, it's been done before. But
it's muddling the evidence, really.
The evidence.
I mean, you know, when you get all this discussion and you get people coming on the radio and saying, you know, well, I don't think this theory can possibly hold any water, but I haven't looked at the website for over a year, when all this new information, the majority of it has been posted in the last year, because, you know, you've had your website upgraded, I think, in that year from, you know, having the original one, which was had very limited storage. So you've been able to post much, much more information on there. And yet, you know, these certain people who are trying to debate the evidence have not actually looked at it. This is what I find so very frustrating.
Yeah, Judy Wood is stupid, but that doesn't mean that, you know, same thing about the data. But there's various ways of derailing folks, but once you look at the data, it's very simple. Like, I like what Andrew often says. It's not controversial which way a car is normally oriented.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Joe Sixpack doesn't have a problem figuring out which way his car normally is oriented.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is it, and this is all that we're saying. And, you know, I would stress again that if people want to explain the data, then they need to have, you know, some type of way of accounting for all the evidence. You know, theory is, you know, you've got that great expression that you use, Judy, evidence is the truth that theory must mimic. That's correct, isn't it?
Yes.
And this is what anybody studying the evidence must do. You can't just ignore the cars. You can't just ignore the stationary hurricane, you know, at this particular point. You can't just put that on one side and pretend it doesn't exist. You have to explain it. And if you're just going to endlessly debate only one or two points of the evidence, you're not going to get anywhere. You're not going to find the truth, and you're not going to get a genuine inquiry, you know. And, you know, what we're really seeing, I think, is people ignoring a good proportion of the evidence and then trying to lead a lot of other people down a particular path. You know, I don't know if you've got any further thoughts on that.
Well, the kitchen sink approach of muddling up the evidence.
Yeah.
If you can't get them to do something else that's irrelevant, you muddle up the good evidence.
Yeah.
And get people to misunderstand it, misinterpret it, like, you know, calling what Judy Wood does space beam.
Yeah. Well, I think I'd just like to close by reading few lines from a song called See Me, Feel Me from Tommy, and it says, right behind you I see the millions, on you I see the glory, from you I get opinion, from you I get the story. And this is an example of a PSYOP getting people to, you know, follow you that you shouldn't follow anyone. You should think for yourself, check the evidence for yourself, and think about it. Carry on thinking and checking as much as you can. Thank you very much for listening, and thank you very much, Judy.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll hope to do this again sometime, and I wish everyone all the best. And please check the evidence that's been posted and the videos, and share the information as much as you possibly can.
It's no secret.